The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning, you are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. Frank DeFord was a familiar presence on National Public Radio's Morning Edition from 1980 until May of this year, and he died about 6 weeks ago at the age of 78. Frank DeFord had a long career, 6 decades writing for Sports Illustrated. He contributed 1,656 weekly commentaries to National Public Radio. We're going to revisit our interview with Frank DeFord, recorded 17 years ago on the Best of the Book Nook, right after NPR News. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in July of 2000, I interviewed Frank DeFord. It was a second appearance for him on the program, and we talked about a book he had just published and also his long career. At the time when I interviewed him, he was approaching the creation of his 1,000th weekly commentary for National Public Radio. And when he died 6 weeks ago, he had contributed 1,656 weekly commentaries for National Public Radio. He had that beautiful voice and that beautiful way of writing. He retired from NPR's Morning Edition on May 3rd. You might recall he also appeared on Home Box Office's Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel for 22 years, and he wrote for Sports Illustrated for many, many years. Just a great writer and a great thinker, and he had that wonderful voice. His recent obituary in the New York Times had this to say, quote, "He displayed that voice, evocative, unhurried, conversational, and that it was." Let's listen now to my interview with Frank DeFord, recorded back in July of 2000 on the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And joining us in the program today is Frank DeFord. You know him as a very familiar voice talking about sports every week on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Also a very well-known sports writer for Sports Illustrated. He's just put out a book called The Best of Frank DeFord. I'm just getting started. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Vic.
Frank, how did you get started? How did you become a sports writer?
I'm one of the sports writers who fell into it. I never intended to be a sports writer. I think that most sports writers really see that as a goal and work toward it. I always wanted to be a writer, but I never really thought that I would be a sports writer. But when I came out of college, I wanted to go to New York. I had an opportunity to go to Sports Illustrated, you know, as a researcher or whatever. And it just sort of grew like Topsy from there. I just sort of woke up one morning and realized I was a sports writer. And I've pretty much stayed in it ever since.
You make the point in your introduction that you really have a couple of almost separate audiences. You've got your audience that listens to you on NPR, and then you've got your audience that reads you in Sports Illustrated. How are they different?
Totally different. I mean, obviously, by definition, anybody who reads Sports Illustrated is going to be, pretty much of a pretty good sports fan. Now, I like to think that they're not just sort of ERA stat freaks, that we have a lot of people who really prize the good writing and the good journalism that Sports Illustrated brings. But notwithstanding, I mean, it's a niche audience. And NPR, on the other hand, is completely different in that it's a very broad, obviously very intelligent audience. And I think I'm very lucky to speak to people who might otherwise not really care that much about sports. I get letters or all the time usually from women who say very nicely, I don't really care about sports, but I've at least learned to listen to you.
How did that happen? How did you get hooked up with NPR?
About 20 years ago, out of the clear blue sky, and this was right after Morning Edition started. I think that was in the fall of 1979. And a young woman named Ketzel Levine, who still does the gardening stuff for NPR, came to New York, and she was just looking for anybody who would sort of fill up the time. And on one trip, she was familiar with my work at Sports Illustrated and asked me if I would be interested. And then she went down to Tallahassee, Florida, because her father had always told her that Red Barber was so engaging and so smart, and got Red to sign up. And all that happened in the space of a couple of days in the fall of 79. And I started my commentaries in January of 1980 and have been doing them ever since, except for a two-year period where I ran a newspaper, and I just couldn't do it. I'm approaching my 1,000th NPR commentary.
Wow.
I think it's about a year away, so we can, we put the bells and whistles away for a while. But if anybody had ever told me that I would do 1,000 of anything, I think I would have ducked out the door.
Well, 20 years, about 50 a year.
Yeah, figure it out.
That adds up. How did you select the pieces that you put in this book?
I threw out some pieces which I thought were very good, but I just thought they were so dated or so obscure. I mean, they related to something that happened 5 or 6 or 10 years ago, and it really disappeared from the face of the earth since then. Apart from that, I looked for a certain amount of variety. There were some pieces I thought that didn't hold up as well in print as they did on radio. I remember I did one in which I did opera. I did a whole opera on the baseball strike.
Huh.
And it just sort of lost something in the translation. And always I'm looking for a certain amount of variety. When I do a humorous piece on NPR, I want to make sure that the next week I come back and do something serious. So I was looking for the same kind of balance in the book. And, of course, it's also true that the book is balanced in that it has a lot of magazine pieces in it as well. It's sort of a bi-media book.
My guest is Frank DeFord. One of my favorite pieces is one of those magazine pieces. It's the one on bowling. I love that piece.
I've heard a lot of people say that. And I did that about 15 years ago. And it is pretty slight. I mean, it's certainly not very serious. But I included it, said, like that. Well, I'll include it. And it seems to have struck a very responsive chord. I had an awful lot of fun doing that. I've never taken a picture any more than a snapshot in my life, but when I did the magazine piece, I took a camera with me and took my own pictures.
And you actually met Richard Nixon?
I met Richard Nixon when he was just beginning his rehabilitation.
Uh-huh.
When did he leave office?
73, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
He leaves office in 74. He departs office in August of 74. And, sort of lay low for the next 4 or 5 years. And then he begins to come out of his shell. And I was doing an article on the city of Washington as a sports city.
Hmm.
And it occurred to me that whatever you think of Mr. Nixon or his politics, he was sort of a classic case. He was a sports fan who came from somewhere else to Washington,
uh-huh.
Which is the way a lot of people do in the government. He was no different from an S-11 or whatever it is working in the Department of Commerce who came from California to Washington. And so I contacted his people. I remember there was a colonel or somebody or other. And they decided, well, this would be a good way for him to sort of step gently back into the spotlight. I wasn't going to ask any difficult questions about embarrassing subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met him in the Waldorf Towers. And you would have thought that I was going to put him on the griddle. He was totally uncomfortable
uh-huh.
the entire time, which just shocked me because I thought, for once in your life, relax. This is going to be about sports. This is going to be about fun.
That was his way, I hear.
I guess he just couldn't be anything else. I remember him playing with a pack of matches the whole time, and I could not avoid thinking of Captain Queeg with the balls. I mean, it was obsessive and very serious the whole time. And, of course, I know the reason you brought it up was because he kept saying to me, why don't you write more about bowling?
Uh-huh.
And he had put a bowling alley into the White House, which I think has long since disappeared. I think they turned it into a swimming pool or something.
Mm.
But I kept trying to explain to him gently that just because people went bowling, they didn't want to read about bowling. But he had, nerd that he was, he had all the bowling statistics and all that sort of thing. It was a fascinating couple of hours, but it was also kind of depressing.
Mm. He was a big sports fan. Rumor was that he used to try to call in plays into various dugouts or into.
Well, he did, in fact, design a play once that George Allen used when he was coaching the Redskins. I think it lost 3 yards. I think Allen was obviously a Republican. You know, his son was is running for the Senate, was the governor of Virginia. And so I guess he felt that you could waste one play for the president of the United States, but it didn't turn out to be a long gainer at all. I don't think they got back to the line of scrimmage.
In case you've just tuned in, our guest today is Frank DeFord, and his book is The Best of Frank DeFord, I'm Just Getting Started. And we're just getting started talking to you. There's so much to talk about, and I'd love to talk about some of the in-depth pieces. The one on bowling is in-depth. You also have another great one about Bill Russell, another one about that great big basketball player, Charles Barkley. These are great pieces, and I know you selected those because you really liked them yourself.
I think that I probably did use an awful lot of prejudicial thought in selecting them, that maybe there were better pieces, but that I it's my selection, and I can do what I want with it.
Uh-huh.
And so I probably did use in the final analysis, I'm sure I picked some pieces because I just simply liked them better than others.
You're listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did with Frank DeFord 17 years ago. He died recently, and we are honoring him with this archival interview, and we'll continue with the second half of my interview with Frank DeFord right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. It's The Best of the Book Nook this morning, and I am revisiting the second interview I did with Frank DeFord in the Book Nook, and this was recorded back in July of 2000. He died in late May, and he was a longtime presence on National Public Radio's Morning Edition with his weekly commentaries. He began them in 1980. And he worked right up till just a couple of weeks before he died. He ended up filing 1,656 weekly commentaries on National Public Radio. Here's the second half of my interview recorded in July 2000 with Frank DeFord. You've got the big piece on Bobby Knight, and I know you've written commentary about him recently with what's going on in Indiana. I think it's outrageous myself.
Oh, the Knight piece was written, I think, in 1970-something, a long, long time ago. And I didn't include it in my first collection because John Feinstein, my colleague at NPR, just came out with the Knight book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought there was no need to sort of coast the Newcastle. But the amazing thing about that Knight piece is it reads as if it was written yesterday, which shows, A, I haven't changed as a writer, and B, he hasn't changed as a person.
It gave really good insight into the problems he has now.
Yeah, you really can read it, and you don't have to worry about the last 25 years. It's quite up to date in that respect. And, of course, that's a large part of the problem with Bob Knight. He doesn't change. Nothing seems to make a dent in him. He's absolutely rigid in the way that he operates and in his beliefs. Some of that one can chalk up to principle, and there are principles in his life that matter and that are good. The rest of it is obstinance and leads him to think that he can be vulgar and so forth without any consequence at all.
Well, the power of sport programs in our major colleges is the problem.
Well, I did a commentary on that because I wanted people to say, wait a minute, it's not just Bob Knight. Bob Knight is a special problem, but the power of these coaches is endemic throughout the country. I mean, it made people feel sort of good to get rid of Bob Knight, but often these people were living in states which had every bit as much the same sort of problem as Bob Knight. They didn't have the personal problem that a coach like that provides, but the problem of athletics over academics is just absolutely something that's common to every part of the United States, and it's a shame.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on some fairly topical issues that are happening right now. Your colleague at SI, who wrote the piece about John Rocker, He's in hot water again for his piece about David Wells. Any thoughts on this?
I have not seen the Wells piece, so I can't speak with authority on it. But Wells didn't like it because it apparently wasn't a Valentine. It talked about how he was sort of a good time Charlie.
Uh-huh.
And it's that, which is demonstrable. I think you can see that on the cover. I think his belly is protruding out of his shirt.
Uh-huh. He's a heck of a pitcher, though.
Oh, and that was a case where the Yankees made a huge mistake. He was not only a great pitcher, but he was also somebody that everybody sort of liked in the clubhouse. And he adored being in New York. And a lot of players don't like to come to New York. And he loved New York. He loved everything about New York. He loved everything about the Yankees. You know, he adores Babe Ruth, everything. And they unloaded him to get Roger Clemens, who was a bigger name. And they made a terrible mistake because Clemens was on the way down and Wells was on the way up. It was a classic case of you know, selling on the stock market at precisely the wrong time.
As I recall, when that deal went down, you wrote a piece bemoaning the fact that the rich were getting richer and that Clemens should never have been sent to the Yankees.
Well, I was wrong because it helped bring the Yankees down. Of course, he did all right for a couple of years or so.
Uh-huh.
But I do still agree with the principle that the sense that you can sort of buy your way out, which is only, by the way, true in baseball. All the other sports have enough rules to prevent that.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of, you know, cornering the market. I think it's a terrible thing for baseball, and I think it's selfish, it's greedy, and it's also in the long run, it even if you are one of the teams that can buy your way out, it works against you because I think it hurts the sport.
Now we see the Cleveland Indians selling the farm by giving their top RBI guy to the Yankees. I was absolutely mortified when I heard about that deal.
Well, I don't understand, unless they feel, the Indians, that it's the kind of Clemens Wells deal, that they're getting rid of Justice at the top of the market, and they're picking up a guy, Levee, who may be on his way up. Now, that's how they would justify it, and time will tell. But after all, unless the Indians have absolutely thrown in the towel this year, they still had a great opportunity, to go to the playoffs, and who knows, lightning strikes and they win the whole thing. It's certainly not impossible.
Well, it reminds me of what the White Sox did a few years ago, which brings us to the subject of wild cards. I love them.
I do, too. I do, too. I think that I know that the fundamentalists have a fit and rail on but I think that you need winners in sport, and there are just too many teams now. And if you don't have sufficient winners, people with a chance to win, fans will tune out. And I think that's particularly true nowadays when there are so many sports competing for their interest. It's possible, you know, the fundamentalists go back and they talk about the great old pennant races when it really mattered and all that sort of thing. Well, there were only 16 teams then. And so you could make the argument that only two of them should survive to the end. But I think it's wonderful that everybody has a chance. And I think that by the way, all the figures prove that, the attendance figures and the ratings. In all sports, people like a second chance. People want somebody. They want to be able to root for their team all the way.
Well, the home runs in baseball are certainly providing some excitement.
Yes, they do, Vic, but you almost wonder at a certain point, does there become too much imbalance in the game? I think home runs are great, but I think that the pitching has declined to the point where it needs help. And it's obvious that you can't just, order up another 100 pitchers from around the world. I think that they've got to make adjustments in the game so that pitchers have a greater chance. The obvious one would be to raise the mound, which they lowered some years ago when the pitching got too good.
Yeah, Bob Gibson's retired now. It's safe.
Yeah, that's right. You can come out now. And also, I think if they just called the strike zone a little more accurately, that would be another thing. I don't subscribe to the theory that they're doctoring up the ball. And as a matter of fact, I did a commentary on that. That's the sort of conspiracy theory of baseball. And it just doesn't work, and it's pretty much been proved that that's not the case any longer.
That's the rabbit balls column?
As everybody calls it, the rabbit ball, or they say it's juiced up. Uh-huh. But I always say, who juiced it up? Who gave the orders? It's impossible to imagine anybody in baseball keeping anything a secret.
Yeah.
So I just don't believe it.
That's a very funny piece. It's included in the Best of Frank DeFord.
Yeah, I had done that, and then I sort of redid it again this year when it all came up again. It just, there's no way anybody in baseball can keep secrets. And there's no way anybody can have that kind of conspiracy. And I don't know how you juice it up anyhow. Bud Selig wouldn't know how to juice up a ball. I wouldn't know how to juice up a ball.
Well, apparently in Haiti, you know, they get the phone call and they just do it.
That's right. And they say, juice up the ball. Uh-huh. Add 6% to it. That's, you know, but everybody loves that kind of conspiracy.
It seems like every week when we look at the sports page, we hear about another incident of an NFL player being involved in something violent. What the heck is going on?
Yeah, there was another sad thing today when the running back Lane in Charlotte was shot, apparently by his wife in some sort of domestic dispute. I think it's been pretty much proven that some sports, notably football, but also, you know, hockey, attract pretty rugged people who have some kind of a bent for violence.
Uh-huh.
I think that we've seen that over and over again. Team sports, by the way, seem to be more prone to violence than individual sports. I think it's sort of the sort of the mob, the safety in the mob. You get these awful group rapes and things like that that happen. I think it's also a case, I mean, quite apart from the horrible violence, but so many athletes today, from such an early age, 11, 12 years old, whatever, are sort of given carte blanche to do whatever they want. And if they do something wrong, somebody comes in and sweeps up after them. And people cheat for them. And they give them things under the table. And I think that an awful lot of athletes simply think, I'm not going to get caught. It isn't going to happen to me. I think that mentality exists more than ever before. I think there are a lot of factors which account for it, but those two most prominently.
My guest is Frank DeFord. His book, The Best of Frank DeFord, I'm Just Getting Started, was just published by Triumph Press, and it's quite a book. I love your account when you're talking to Bill Russell, and he explains to you why you can never be his friend, and you bemoan the fact in your foreword, in your introduction, that it used to be possible for sports writers and athletes to be friends, and now things are different. I think about the incident with Dan Shaughnessy of the Globe and Carl Everett the other day. That sense of decorum seems to be gone.
Yeah, Russell was an old friend of mine. That piece, by the way, won the National Magazine Award. I told Bill Russell, I said, you know, you're such a great team player that once I got on your team as a writer, you won an award for me. You win a championship, you know, despite you can't help it. But I knew Russell back then, and I knew a lot of athletes back then in the 60s and 70s when I first got into this business. And it was natural for athletes and writers to sort of hang out together. We were making basically the same amount of money. Athletes had to find jobs in the off season. They really were very much like normal people then, who just happened to have a talent and a certain amount of fame. But the adversarial relationship has developed over the years, and a huge chasm between the athlete and the writer. That's not to say that we were all sweethearts back then. I remember the Cincinnati writer Earl Lawson getting popped, I think, by Veda Pinson one time. I mean, you know, we had our moments. But by and large, there was the opportunity to be friendly. It was the natural order of things to be friendly. And a curious thing, I'm pretty sure that very few athletes read anything anymore. So they really don't know what these writers are doing. They just don't sort of have any idea. It just doesn't occur to them. I think they get all of their news from SportsCenter on ESPN. And I think that adds to the distance, because they simply look upon writers as these sort of gnats who get in their way, that they have to be sort of waved off.
Well, it's amazing how much sports blends into the national fabric. And even if you're not a person who follows sports, you hear about this stuff going on. And, of course, we all know about Pete Rose being here in the Cincinnati area. You have your piece in the book where you basically say Pete Rose deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Sparky is going there this year. We had Sparky on the program a year or so ago. Sparky thinks Pete should be in the Hall of Fame. But as long as Bart Giamatti's buddy, Bud Selig, is the commissioner, it's not going to happen.
I'm afraid that's true, that these guys simply refuse. They're worse than popes, in a way. I mean, popes at least change rules occasionally. But never mind Pete Rose. They won't let poor Shoeless Joe Jackson into the Hall of Fame, and he's been dead 50 years, and they gave him a lifetime suspension, and as Ted Williams points out, the lifetime suspension presumably ended when he died. You can't keep a lifetime suspension going into the afterlife, but baseball does. And I think that so many people think that both Jackson and Rose, whether they are guilty or not, deserve to be in the Hall of Fame for the reasons of what they did on the field, and that nothing else should matter. That's my own attitude. I don't have any doubts that Rose bet on baseball. I think that the Dowd report more or less proves that. He more or less admitted to it. But I just don't think that's germane insofar as the Hall of Fame is concerned. And most people, I think, feel that way. I think that the other thing is that if you've ever seen Pete in action, post-baseball, he really uses this very much to his advantage. He plays the martyr, and the fact that he's not in the Hall of Fame makes him much more attractive than if he is in the Hall of Fame. And you actually can go to Cooperstown, and he'll be there signing autographs and drawing much larger crowds than other ball players who are in the Hall of Fame. he's wearing that red scarlet letter, and he stands out. And that letter is not a C, it's an A.
I think many of us look to sports for our role models, for our heroes. And then when we see people like John Rocker or Mike Tyson or Dennis Rodman, it's sort of scary. It's really fortunate that we have other people out there like Tiger Woods.
I've often said that you just simply can't expect a bunch of young men, particularly rich, spoiled young men, to, as a group, be necessarily wonderfully distinctive. You're going to have some bad ones, and I think kids are pretty understanding of that. I don't think that they're quite as shaken when it turns out that their idols have feet of clay as perhaps we think they do. Maybe once upon a time, when the kind of troubadours of sport built up athletes, to all be paragons, that was true. But kids today, they have television. They have so much thrown at them. And I don't think they're surprised when they find out that not all of the players are less than exemplary human beings. I think it's still good that you can look up to athletes. That's fine. And if you have to get a shattered image every now and then, go on and find somebody else.
Well, Frank, I know of some folks who look up to you. In fact, I got a number of calls and emails from listeners who were excited about you being here, including this one from a listener in Fairborn, Ohio. He sent me an email today, and he said, "Frank DeFord is one of my very favorite authors for sentences like the following, written recently in Sports Illustrated about tennis player Anna Kournikova." He says, quote, "On the court, she is like a trim sloop skimming across the surface, her long signature pigtail flying about like a torn spinnaker in the wind." And he says, Hemingway would be proud of that sentence.
Well, thank you very much, Bear Bourne. That's very, very kind of you.
It's great to hear from your fans, isn't it?
It is, and I don't think you ever get tired of it. And I do, you know, I'm genuinely pleased when somebody reads something like that and it admires it. I mean, yeah, I like it very much, because a lot of people gave me a lot of grief for writing the article about Anna Kournikova. I was sort of the messenger bringing the bad news, which is to say, I wasn't saying she's this extraordinary figure. I'm saying it's simply the case that we've never had anybody like her ever before, so popular, on a basis of her looks. Anybody in athletics who is simply this creature of beauty who's managed to become as popular as she has. It's absolutely a phenomenon. And a lot of people say, well, you shouldn't be writing about her. You should be writing about Lindsay Davenport. Well, Anna Kournikova is a more interesting story. That's all. It really is a phenomenon. And I took pains to say that, no, she wasn't the best player. And as a matter of fact, I thought she'd peaked and never really would amount to anything. But she's a fascinating example, no less than Dennis Rodman or John Rocker, of how sports can throw up people who are not just champions.
It sounds like you're not planning on retiring anytime soon.
No. That's one of the great things about being a writer. You don't punch a clock, and I guess you can go on writing until you lose your faculties or until they put you in the grave. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have the idea. I've been doing it since I was 12 years old. I think I would have tremendous withdrawal pains. I'd have to go into one of those 12-step programs, I think, to get through it.
Well, for those of us who are public radioites, we really look forward to your pieces every week on Morning Edition, and it's really great to have you on the program.
Well, Vic, I've enjoyed it very much, and thank you so much for talking about the book. It's been my pleasure.
My guest has been Frank DeFord. The book is The Best of Frank DeFord. I'm Just Getting Started, and it was just published by Triumph Books. You're listening to The Book Nook. If you could hold the line, Frank.
Yep.
And that was Frank DeFord. And as you heard at the end of that interview, I said if you could stay on the line, because we used to record all of our interviews in The Book Nook live, and sometimes I was able to chat with the author after we went off the air and keep him on the phone for a few moments, and sometimes we got the really good stuff by doing that. And Frank DeFord appeared on NPR from 1980 until early May of this year. He worked right up to the end. And as he mentioned in that interview, he said he was going to keep doing it until something puts you in the grave. And he did. He kept it right up to the end. And as time passes, we were talking about athletes during that interview, and we were talking about ones who we could hold on a pedestal, and we mentioned Tiger Woods, and he said some athletes have feet of clay, and it turned out 17 years later that Tiger Woods is no exception. We've seen his career slightly tarnished here in the last few years. And he also talked about Pete Rose and how Pete Rose deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And he also mentioned Shoeless Joe Jackson, who is still not in the Hall of Fame. Even all these years after he died, he was involved in the Black Sox scandal where they threw the World Series for the Chicago White Sox. Several players lost their careers as baseball players in that scandal. And his comment was, "You can't keep a lifetime suspension going into the afterlife." Well, Frank, we're going to miss your voice on the radio, and we're going to miss your great writing. And that's our tribute to Frank DeFord. And don't go away. I've got a special Book Nook bonus coming your way in our final segment right after this. You're listening to The Best of The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. And in the first parts of the program, we had our 2000 interview with Frank DeFord. And now I'm going to close out the program with an interview segment from something we recorded last year. Ben Winters wrote a novel called Underground Airlines, And it was one of the sleeper picks of last year in fiction, a great novel. It made many best of the year lists, and it just came out in paperback. And we're going to listen to a portion of this alternative history interview. Imagine that the Civil War never happened. That's what he imagined in Underground Airlines. Here's Ben Winters from the Best of the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to welcome to the program today Ben Winters. His new book is Underground Airlines. He joins us by telephone from somewhere in Southern California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
Ben, I read this book in a galley about 6 months ago, and I just absolutely flipped, and now it's out. Wow, this book is getting some buzz. What do you think, man? Have you ever had a book this exciting? I know you've written a few books.
No, I mean it's definitely has. I think because of the subject matter and because of what it is, it has touched a nerve to a certain extent. Has reached a lot of people that some of my previous work hasn't, which is really exciting. And I hope that people are enjoying it once they actually read it. You know, like I feel like a book. Books are interesting because they do. They get buzz and they get hype and they get reviews, and there's a sort of it's a cultural object that there's a conversation around. But then when you sit down to read a book, it's just you and the book. You know, it's just a person experiencing the book, and so it's a sort of different thing. So I hope that when people take it home and they're actually reading it, they have that a good, powerful experience with it.
The book is Underground Airlines by Ben H. Winters. And our central character is a guy named Victor. He's a very complicated fellow. How did you get the idea for this?
Well, so just so your listeners know who haven't heard of the book, it's set in a version of the United States. There's an alternate history background. And so we are living in a version of the United States that is quite like the current version, the real version, except that slavery was never abolished. Lincoln was assassinated in 1861 before the Civil War, before the Emancipation Proclamation. And so slavery is still the law under the federal constitution and is still in force in four southern states. Now, the book takes place in the north, and it is about the hunt for an escaped slave. And the hero, or rather, the anti-hero, the protagonist, at least, his name is Victor, as you say, and he's an African-American man who works undercover as a bounty hunter, basically. He is sort of spy working for the U.S. Marshal Service to recover runaway slaves. And if to answer the question, it came very much from current events, from my sense of where we are as a country and where we wish we were. I think, like so many people, I've been continually startled and horrified and confused, I guess, by the continuing incidences of police violence in Black communities and these sort of ongoing questions of why is this still happening? Why are people still being shot? What are the institutions and attitudes that are still with us that we thought we did away with at the time of slavery, at the end of slavery? So it became this speculative idea became, if I feel like, and as I think many people feel like, in a way slavery is still with us, let's make that it's true that slavery is still with us, and see what sort of light that idea shines on the contemporary situation.
Well, it really could have happened if you studied history. It was possible that Lincoln could have been assassinated before he was inaugurated. If you go back, you'll see that when he made the train trip to Washington for his inauguration from Illinois, he had to keep switching trains, and they actually were plotting to get him in Baltimore. Were you aware of this when you wrote this?
Yeah, there were multiple whispers, campaign, ideas of how to kill him, and there was, and the way I do it is in Indianapolis because he gave a speech from a hotel balcony in Indianapolis that was very poorly received because it was seen as sort of an attack an unduly and unnecessarily aggressive attack on the southern position. And then the next morning he had to go out and sort of walk it back a little bit. So I did. I was aware of the history, and I think it was just an interesting point in time where history could have gone another way. Now, the question is whether, even if Lincoln had been assassinated, whether in truth there still wouldn't have been a civil war. You know, it's possible that his successor administration would have pursued a course of war, or the South would have forced the issue regardless, or that 10 years after that there would have been a war. Who, you know, of course, we have no way of knowing. And then some people argue that even if there hadn't been a civil war, slavery would have withered away, it's the phrase that is used, in a generation or two. But, of course, we can't know that. And what is so striking to me in antebellum history is the way these compromises were hammered out over and over again in 1793, in 1820, in 1850, in the Missouri Compromise. America kept finding ways to re-enshrine slavery. And so it didn't feel that difficult to imagine a set of further compromises that would keep kicking this can down the road until the present day, as horrible as that is to imagine.
Well, even though underground airlines deals with some very serious topics, it seems to me, reading it, that it must have been a real kick to write it, because I can tell you're having fun with this. Just the stuff you envision. You've got Victor, your fugitive slave catcher, who is a former slave himself, and he's driving around in his car playing Michael Jackson. I mean, I just love these images that you create of this alternate world.
Well, I will say, fun isn't quite the right word, because the book is so, although it is a mystery, it's a thriller, and it has elements of pop culture in it. The subject matter is grim. You know, it's quite serious, obviously. And so although there was joy, as there always is in writing a book, and imagining the details and figuring out this character and who he is, I tried never to lose sight of the fact that this book is very much related to the real world. And so, it wasn't me attempting to use slavery at this terrible history and our quite, the bad things about the present as a sort of backdrop for a thriller. You know, I really wanted it to be that I was using the thriller tropes and the sort of fun stuff as a way to think about and to get inside this very important issue, But yeah, it was interesting and kind of fun, and it taxed my imagination in interesting ways, I guess, to think about who this man was and what his likes and dislikes would be, and the way he sort of managed to remain sane and remain, to survive and to do this job, even though he was constantly aware in some part of himself of that he really is doing the devil's work. This is really, he really is sacrificing his own morality and his own conscience to stay alive.
Well, Ben, I know in some of your previous work, you've developed a reputation for writing literary mashups. And this book is kind of a mashup in that regard, as far as mashing up the history.
Well, I suppose that's true. It is a kind of, it's almost like flattening is the way I started to think of it, of American history, of saying we're going to take elements from our past and put them into the present, And I think one of the things that does is allow us to see how much of the past still is part of our present. We like to think of slavery as something that ended such a long time ago that has no real bearing, no relationship to the present. But if you look at contemporary society, there are a lot of ways that we are still sort of shadowed by racist attitudes and by racist institutions that really emerged right out of slavery. So it's interesting, So yeah, it's a mashup of past and present, and it's a mashup also, I think, of a certain kind of sort of speculative form of science fiction, this sort of what if novel, with the thriller and mystery novels that I so love. It mm-hmm. takes this alternate history idea, but it's not just an alternate history novel. It really is a mystery story. It's an espionage novel also.
And Victor's handler with the U.S. Marshals Service, a guy named Mr. Bridge, keeps a very tight control over Victor. Let's talk about their relationship.
Yeah. Well, so Bridge is really, for Victor, most of the novel, he's just a voice on the telephone, sort of issuing instructions requesting information, keeping tabs, making sure that Victor is sort of stays on the reservation, so to speak, and making sure he finishes these jobs and finds his man. And Victor, Bridge is a very dry, very no-nonsense kind of character, almost in the mold of a, you know, Joe Friday. You know, he just doesn't mess around. And so Victor sometimes teases him a little, tries to get a laugh out of him, tries to expand their relationship and sort of find out what Bridge's deal is. And he's constantly imagining what Bridge must look like. But there's at the heart of their relationship, at the very core of it, it is, in a way, a master-slave relationship. Bridge has all the cards. And Victor, in one of the novel's few very sort of outright science fiction conceits, Victor has a sort of computer chip tracking, a GPS chip in his it's actually an RFID chip, but it's in his in the base of his spinal column, or at the base of his brain, I should say, the top of his spinal column, that through which he is monitored and controlled by the United States Marshal Service. And again, that was me sort of updating what slavery would be like if it were now, you know, if it had access to contemporary technology and contemporary means of control.
Even though he's supposedly not a slave, he's got this chip in him.
Right, that's the irony, is that he has earned his, he has escaped to freedom, but his freedom comes at the terrible everyday price of working to keep other people in slavery. And so I should say, I mean, I think the novel is, without spoiling anything, it's about his journey towards a truer kind of freedom.
And as readers, we wonder, we are puzzled, because as we get to know this character in the early parts of the book, we're wondering, why is he doing this? We don't really know about the control then, and we're wondering, why is he so good at his job? Why is he such a good fugitive slave hunter? Being a former slave, I suppose he would know where to look for an escaped slave, but why is he so zealous? Yeah. We can't figure that out.
Yeah, and you know, and I have a line in there somewhere too, where he says, you know, it can be pretty satisfying doing the devil's work. There are times when he finds himself enjoying it, and then castigates himself for that too, you know. And he's a complicated character, and I think there are a lot of layers to him. I think that for all of the novel's sort of high concept business and the alternate history and the mystery and the thriller and the science fiction, like at its heart, for me, it really is a character study, and it's about this man. And it's about how we, as a reader, fall for him almost despite ourselves, hopefully, and come to root for him and want him to figure this out and to make himself whole, which I think represents my own sense of wanting us as a country to sort of figure this out and make ourselves whole. You know, like, I think we need to figure out a way to reckon with our past, to understand better why it is that we're still fighting the fights that we're fighting, and we're still as locked in a way of looking at other people as we always have been.
In this alternate version of the United States, the modern America, where slavery is still legal, you envision these four southern states that you call the Hard Four, where the slavery is still taking place. And as the story shifts to the Hard Four, Victor escaped from there, and now he's being sent back in there. This is where, as a reader, you really ratchet up the tension, and it really becomes a thriller. This was the part of the book that I just absolutely loved reading. I mean, you just really did it up on that section. Let's talk about the Hard Four and what it was and what's going on there.
Sure. Well, the Hard Four are Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Carolina, a combined Carolinas. Because of basically in the backstory, at some point, this is very small piece of the book, but the Carolinas, through some legislative action to avoid either one of them becoming free, they combined into one larger state. And so, yeah, the Hard Four are the four states where slavery is still legal. And in various points in the book, I give I sketch out some of the history of when, for example, Tennessee or Virginia or Florida, you know, when other states were pressured into or decided to end slavery. But there are four, and the slave industries include still cotton and other textiles, as well as shrimp boats and oil fields and sugarcane, various kinds of industries, and the plantation, the quote unquote plantation that Victor has to sort of infiltrate in that section of the novel is a combined, massive sort of agricultural combination of cotton fields and cotton processing gins and mills and a sweatshop, and actual places where they make clothing for export. Because one of the sort of things about the book is that a lot of northern states in the novel will not import the product of slave labor. So the slave states actually export their materials overseas. So there's this complicated triangulated economy where the northern states, although they are still one union with the southern states, like to think themselves at a remove from the economic benefit of slavery because they don't actually buy the stuff. So Victor has to, he basically has to break into this massive, highly securitized facility to find what he's looking for.
That was Ben Winters talking about his novel Underground Airlines. It just came out in paperback, and that was something we recorded last year when the book came out in hardcover. You've been listening to the best of the book, Nook. We began today with our interview from 2000 with Frank DeFord, who died recently. For the best of the book, Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening.